They went to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took with him Peter and James and John and began to be distressed and agitated. He said to them, "I'm deeply grieved, even to death. Remain here, keep awake." And going a little farther, he threw himself to the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass him by. "Abba, Father," he prayed, "for you all things are possible. Remove this cup from me. Yet let your will be done, not mine." So the question I want you to ask yourselves, and I'll ask myself, is, well, it's quite clear what Jesus' will is. He's expressed it. He didn't want to die. He didn't want to yet. He didn't want to stop his mission, which had hardly been very successful, apparently. That's what he wanted. He wanted time to carry on his mission. But he says, "Father, I want your will to be done, not mine." And my question is, what is God's will? I'm asking the question, and I'm hoping what I say won't be too much of a surprise to any of you, but it might be, because I was taught in younger years, a long time ago, and you were probably taught an answer to that question, which I wish to challenge. Let's begin with the homily that Peter gave after the resurrection to the crowd in Acts chapter 3, and he says, "God has glorified his servant Jesus, whom you handed over and rejected in the presence of Pilate, though he had decided to release him. But you rejected the Holy and Righteous One. You asked to have a murderer given to you, and you killed the author of life. But God raised him from the dead." As Peter sees it, God's part in what happened on Calvary is the resurrection. The killing of Jesus was something that Pilate gave in to under pressure from the Jewish leaders. Stephen, when he was about to be stoned a bit later in the Acts, Luke writes, has Stephen say, "You stiff-necked people, you're forever opposing the Holy Spirit. Just as your ancestors used to do. Which of the prophets did your ancestors not persecute? They killed those who foretold the coming of the Righteous One, and now you have become his betrayers and murderers." When Stephen looks to why did Jesus die, he looks straight at the Jewish leaders who've carried on a long tradition of rejecting truth, in fact, murdering the Messiah. I know you know all this, but I do want you to focus on it because I want to take you somewhere. In what might be the earliest writing of the New Testament, though I actually think Galatians is older, but it's in any case, it's written very early, 17 years after the death of Jesus. We have Paul writing, "You became imitators of the churches of God in Christ Jesus that are in Judea. You Thessalonians are suffering the way the Judean Christians did, for you suffered the same things as your own compatriots as they did from the Jews, who killed both the Lord Jesus and the prophets and drove us out. They displeased God." It's quite clear to Paul that what the Jewish leaders did to Jesus displeased God. Is against the will of God. Psalm 5 verse 4 reads, "You are not a God who delights in sin." And I'm sure you'd all agree, it's quite obvious, the murder of Jesus was a sin. It does displease God. God has no delight in murder. And now let's get even deeper. Jesus' last parable. The parables are put all together in the Gospels for the most part, but this one is right at the end of Jesus' life, and you know it well. It's about an owner of a vineyard who sent slaves to collect the produce. "Some," says Jesus, "they beat, others they killed." He still had one other, a beloved son. This is Jesus' own words. This is his understanding of what was happening. God is saying, "Look, I've got one other, my beloved son." Finally, he sent him to them, saying, "Surely they will respect my son." Surely, when they see his love, they'll realize how wrong they are. Surely they'll embrace him. Surely they will get to know who I really am. Surely my will now will be done on earth as it is in heaven, because they'll see through Jesus who God really is. Surely, surely. "But," says Jesus, "those tenants said to one another, 'This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours.' So they seized him, killed him, and threw him out on the vineyard." Earlier in the public ministry of Jesus, speaking to them, Jesus says, "Look, you're looking for an opportunity to kill me." And please note what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, comma, "because you are carrying out the eternal will of my Father for the salvation of humankind." He doesn't say that. He says, "You are waiting for an opportunity to kill me because there's no place in you for my word." They reject the word made flesh because they reject God's word. That's why they kill him. They reject God. John chapter 8, Jesus said, "When you've lifted up the Son of Man, you will realize that I am." Now you probably know, but let me tell you in case you mightn't. I am, those two words that come again and again, particularly, but not only, in the Gospel of John. I am, this is written in Greek, of course, that's the Greek translation of Yahweh, the burning bush. "Who are you," says Moses, "so I can tell people who's sending me?" And he says, "I am." So, here's Jesus saying, John's words, of course. When you've lifted up the Son of Man, you'll realize that I am. You'll realize who God is. That God is the saving God, the God of Moses, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that we did in our first talk a couple of days ago with Pauline. I am. That's who God is. They'll see it. And that I do nothing on my own. I speak the things the Father instructed me. And the one who sent me is with me. He has not left me alone. I always do what pleases him. What a beautiful thing to say. And we expect it from Jesus. But wouldn't it be wonderful if we could say that too? I always do what is pleasing to him. So we're back at the agony and we're hearing Jesus say, Father, you know what I want. You know my will. But you can do everything. Take the chalice from me. But he comes to that wonderful place where he says, but I want to do your will. I always do what pleases you, not my own. What is God's will for Jesus? That he be murdered? Hardly. God doesn't plan injustice, sin, rejection. The letter to the Hebrews tells us that Jesus' prayer in the agony was answered. So let's look at what the Hebrew says. In the days of his flesh, that is, before his death, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to the one who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. Although he was son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And having been made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. How did God hear Jesus' prayer in the agony? We saw it in the opening icon. By taking Jesus, not stopping him being killed, but taking him through death into his own embrace, which we call the resurrection. He was saved out of death, not by avoiding it, but by being taken through it by his Father. So let's come back to the agony. Abba, Father, for you all things are possible. Remove this cup from me, yet let your will, not mine, be done. What is God's will? The Gospels don't elaborate on that. This, what I'm going to share with you now, is totally consistent with them, I hope. But all I can do is do what you do when you're praying, try to enter into the mystery and keep in mind the teaching of the church and the whole of the New Testament, and I've looked at a fair bit of it with you just now, and try to somehow get an inkling of what God's will was. So all I'm going to do now for the next 5 or so minutes is share with you my best thoughts about it. And they've got no more value than that, but they may help. And I hope they're right. Could Jesus' agony, and the words used in the Greek are the strongest words you can use. It's like a whole mental breakdown. It's like he's been holding something, even through the Last Supper, which we'll be looking at later, of course. Even through there and the betrayal, he's been holding something. And then he just breaks down, really. Why? Is he afraid of being crucified? Probably. Who wouldn't be? But that can't be the point of it. Is he thinking that maybe he's failed God? God, after all, sent him to reveal God, to reveal God as love. And we know he did it very beautifully. But who picked it up? Have the Roman army changed? No. Have the high priest and the establishment changed? No. Have the people really picked up the message? No. They're like every crowd, they're going to be as fickle as anything. A few have got it, his mother's got it, obviously, and there's others that you'll see at the foot of the cross, Mary of Magdalene and a few other women that were there, and the disciples are half there. But soon after this, the disciples flee. Jesus knows they're not ready for him to die. In other words, the mission can hardly continue. I mean, if he dies now, the whole thing, I'm only imagining, Jesus could well be thinking, the whole thing has fallen through. He's failed God. Is he thinking, maybe I shouldn't have confronted the high priest in the temple so soon, because that was the key reason for him being killed at this time. He said he'd destroy the temple in 3 days or raise it up, you know that. He was called the King of the Jews. Well, he never called himself the King of the Jews, but that's what's put on the cross. That's the accusation. The accusation made to Pilate will be that he's challenging Pilate. And Pilate doesn't want to be challenged, so he washes his hands and hands him over. Is Jesus thinking deep in his soul, something's going very wrong? But he comes to, in that agony, a place we're all asked to come to. He comes to that place of peace and strength, clarity, when he says, I'll do your will. Meaning, whatever the cost, whatever happens, I'll still embrace lepers, and no one's going to stop me embracing lepers. I'll still eat with sinners. And if I get into trouble because I'm eating with sinners, so be it. I'll still confront the temple authorities. And if that means I'm going, he doesn't know what's going to happen the next day, of course. Pilate could change his mind. He might listen to his wife even, who said, look, don't be going on with all this rubbish. The high priest may even, Joseph of Arimathea did, and he was in the Sanhedrin. So the high priest could have said, look, we've been getting this all wrong. Jesus is about love. God is about love. Go and read your prophets again. We've been getting this really, really wrong. That could have happened. Jesus can't foresee the future, and you can't. In fact, no one can, because it's dependent on free human will. So it looks likely the vultures are gathering. It looks terribly likely. But is Jesus saying, when he says, I'll do your will, is he saying what I've been trying to share with you? No matter what, no one can stop you loving, and I'm going to continue to love. And he does. And he doesn't back down when he's tried by the Sanhedrin, and he doesn't back down when he's tried by Pilate, and he doesn't wilt under the pressure of the crowd. He knows what to do. And I hope by now I might have shattered any thought you had that what he had to do was go and get crucified to save the world. Heaven's sake. That's what we did. It was people that murdered Jesus, not God. So we come to his dying on the cross, his self-giving on the cross. Jesus, as Mark, gave a loud cry and breathed his last. and the curtain of the temple was rent in two from top to bottom. I used to think, hundreds of years ago it feels, that Jesus died on the cross and somehow or other a miracle happened 200 yards down the road, and God, to show his displeasure, ripped the curtain, or got an angel to do it. I don't know, I'd never worked it out, but the curtain was rent. I thought, oh, so the sodality of women, I presume, would have to come and mend it all before the next feast or something. I don't know what was going on, but that's what I used to think when I was that high. Maybe I was told it, I don't know. But that's not what it's about. The curtain of the temple was rent in two from top to bottom. Go back to the baptism of Jesus. The heavens were rent at the baptism, torn apart. And that takes us back to Isaiah and that prayer in Isaiah chapter 64, where the disciples of Isaiah back in Judea, in Jerusalem after the trial, most of the leadership are thinking, we can't go through this trial again. We must be pure now. We must do God's will. So they tightened everything down. All Moabite wives had to be sent back, and everyone was following the rules really strictly. Nothing wrong with following rules strictly, but that was their whole vision. They'd lost anything except the disciples of Isaiah. And they're saying to God, for God's sake, do something. Rend the heavens open. Come down, because we need you. Because we're losing the vision of the prophets. We're getting back into an ecclesiastical tightrope thing. And Mark is telling us that when Jesus was baptized and came out of the water, the heavens were rent apart. Jesus is the revelation of God. On the feast of Yom Kippur, going back to the curtain, that was the only time in the Jewish liturgy where the high priest alone could go through the curtain into the presence of God there with the cherubim on either side and the Ark of the Covenant and that mercy seat, and then a little space between the wings of the cherubim where God, they believed, can't be seen, can't be imaged, touches the earth. Well, that's a very sacred place. No one could go in there. High priest once a year, only after 40 days of washing and new vestments and everything new. And then he went in there with the sins of the people, the incense, and of course the sins all got burnt away in the presence of God, because you can't have sin where God is. It just went away. And then he came out, and again, everything had to be changed. And you know the story of the scapegoat and so on. So that happened once a year. Now, when Jesus dies on the cross, the curtain is rent. The curtain that separates you and me and the centurion and the whole world, in fact. Everyone can come now. Everyone can see the face of God on the face of Jesus, as we see it in that icon. Both aspects. Tremendous suffering, which is against the will of God, and extraordinary communion, which is the will of God for Jesus. And because when Jesus died so beautifully, gave his life, he wasn't just a victim of other people's cruelty, though he was that, he died freely. And so we see the face of God. That's what we're being told by the curtain being torn. The curtain that reveals God's face. And the text goes on, when the centurion who stood facing him, this is very beautiful, and it's in the text, and I don't know why we missed it so much, saw how he died. Not that he died. We're not saved because Jesus died. Jesus dying doesn't save anyone. It didn't save Jesus, and it didn't save anybody. It can't. Death doesn't save us. But the way he died is what the centurion saw. And this is the end of Mark's gospel here. He said, truly, this man was God's son. He sees something divine in the way Jesus died. The love, the care, the compassion, the forgiveness, the trust, the prayer, the communion, all of this was stunning, so stunning that one of the thieves on the cross said, well, there's something going on here that's beyond me, and he wanted to be part of it, as you know. And Jesus said, today you'll be with me in paradise. The very opening words of Mark's Gospel, and you may know that Mark's Gospel traditionally, right from the very early centuries, was the Gospel of Peter. Peter was the inspirer. Mark was the writer, but I'm sure he went back to Peter again and again, and Peter said, oh look, that's not good enough. It was much more beautiful than that. Go and write it again, please. And then Mark eventually ends up with this masterpiece that Luke borrows and Matthew borrows, as you know, and adds so much to. Well, the first verse of that gospel to set the pattern for Mark is the beginning of the gospel of Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. 2 points. The first half of Mark's Gospel, which ends at Caesarea Philippi, when Peter says, you are the Messiah, the Christ. That's the first part. The second part ends with a centurion. The world, in other words, the non-Jewish world. Everyone, it's obvious, because the curtain has been torn. And if we look on the face of Jesus, we must see who God really is. This is indeed the Son of God. So, what have I been trying to share with you? Jesus' death was brought about by others. Please, let's look at God at the right end. God wasn't hammering the nails in. God is in. Where are you going to find God anywhere? You probably know the medieval hymn, where there is love, there is God. Ubi caritas et amor Deus ibi est. Very ancient medieval hymn. Where there's love, there's God. So if you want to see where God is on Calvary, and you do, and I do, for God's sake, look to see where the love is. You won't see it anywhere else. You won't see it with Pilate washing his hands, heavens. And you won't see it with the high priest saying he must be crucified. And you won't see it in the fickle crowd, or the Pharisees, or the whatever. You'll only see it where it's love. So you'll see it with Mary, and you'll see it with the beloved disciple, of course, and you'll see it with Mary of Magdala, and you'll see it with the crowd going home thinking, God, we've done something awful here. We better think about this. As they go home from the Calvary, you'll see it wherever there's love. But the love that you're going to watch, of course, is Jesus. His death was brought about by others. The way he died was determined by Jesus himself. And that's the revelation, that's the beauty, that's the freedom, that's God. It was Jesus' love-giving, life-giving and self-giving that God willed. He wanted Jesus to keep on loving, no matter what other people did sinfully. And that's what he wants you to do, of course, and me, all of us. There is nothing else to do. Thanks to Jesus' fidelity to his Father's will, not even the injustice and disobedience of those who crucified Jesus could thwart God's eternal design. Because of the way Jesus died, which was totally consistent with everything he'd ever done, that is the source of our faith, our conviction, the birth of the church, the gift of the Spirit. It all comes from Jesus faithfully revealing who God is. God, says Mark, followed by Matthew, why have you forsaken me? It's from Psalm 22, verse 1. The authors of the gospel, in this case I'd suggest Peter, is saying, look, the best place we could go to see what Jesus felt on the cross, or what was actually going on, because they were standing at a distance watching it, but after years of meditation and sharing and catechesis and the wonder of conversion coming from the non-Jewish world, all this stunning stuff as the church like wildfire spread wherever people were hungry for love, because of that, he says, look, go and read Psalm 22. And it's not perfect, it's not all about Jesus, it doesn't, much of it won't fit, but a lot will. And I have a little suggestion to make to you, and it's only a suggestion. The 10th verse of Psalm 22 reads, you have been my God. The Hebrew I've got there for you in English lettering is Eli. El is God, as you probably know. Eli is my God. Ata is you. My God, you. That could well have been what Jesus actually said. Because when you're crucified, you can only get two or three words out because you're dying of asphyxiation. You can't get a sentence out. Was Jesus actually praying this psalm? Quite likely. Did he actually say, Eli Ata? And that triggered the memory of the psalm, and hence, my God, why have you forsaken me? I suggest that because there's an unusual thing happens on the cross. You'll remember when Jesus cried those words, they said he's calling on Elijah. And then they ran and put the poker into the drugged wine and held it up, waiting for Elijah to come. Why would they think that? Well, a suggestion again only is, Elijah come in Aramaic, which is the language of Jesus, is Eliyata. Eliyah, Elijah, ta, come. So listen with your ears and I'll say both things to you and you probably won't hear any difference. Eliyata. Eliyata. Depends where you pause, that's all. So maybe, again, I'll leave it now, what at least Jesus was certainly in prayer and he's certainly crying out to his Father. And the Gospel writers are telling us to go to Psalm 22 if we want to get a feel for it. And I'm just suggesting to you that maybe Jesus' words, it's only a thought, is Jesus would have said, Eliyata. Misunderstood by the bystanders, but coming from the heart of Psalm 22, where Jesus is certainly saying whatever words he used, you are my God. John chapter 19 has Jesus say, I thirst. Thirst. Because his mouth is dry? Yes, why not? But you'd all know that there's something far more profound than that being said here. He's thirsting for love. God is thirsting for love. God who is love. As you all know, if you love someone, you need their response. If you don't get it, it's very hurtful. So God is thirsting for your love, for you to know who God is, for me to know it, and for us to live as disciples of Jesus, revealing that love, whatever the cost. Luke has different words. He has Jesus saying, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit, which was Psalm 31, verse 5. And every pious Jew at the bedside, as it were, their last prayer at night was Psalm 31, verses 1 to 5. That was the night prayer expected of an observant Jew. Jesus would have learnt it at his mother's knee and said it all his life. And here he is, Luke, beautifully discovering that, says, oh yeah, go and read Psalm 22. I'd love you to, because Matthew and Mark suggest it, but I've got another thought for you. Why don't you go and read Psalm 31 and hear Jesus saying this and ask you to say it too. Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. After he died, John alone has this extraordinary scene. One of the soldiers pierced Jesus' side with a spear, and at once blood and water came out. And right from the earliest fathers of the church, the blood has been the symbol of the Eucharist and the water of baptism. You could have done that too. It's kind of obvious in a way, but it's the birth of the church from the heart of Jesus pierced on Calvary. The piercing of the heart takes us back to Numbers chapter 20, verse 11, where Moses strikes the rock. And he strikes it a second time, and out of the rock comes water. The rock is a symbol of God, of course, and having sin is striking at God. And even, this is what Paul came to see, that even when I was a sinner, he loved me. When we struck at God's heart by our sin, all we got back was love. Well, how overwhelming is that? John 19:37 takes us to a text from the prophet Zechariah. They will look on the one they've pierced. That's what we're asked to do this week. Look at the one I have pierced, you have pierced, we have pierced. And when we look at the one we've pierced, amazingly, we don't get caught up in our own, implode into our own sin the way Judas seems to have, though please God at the end he repented of it. He certainly threw the money back and he was in a dreadful state. So we can only pray that all those jokes we tell about Peter at the pearly gate, it's probably Judas, because he'd understand everything, who knows. And please God anyhow. So looking on the one we've pierced and seeing love come in, because all God wants us to somehow get beyond our sinfulness, look out and learn to love again, because nothing, not even sin, can stop us loving. Looking at ourselves now in the light of those two meditations, I don't have any words better than this that Paul writes for us. I've been crucified with the Messiah, says Paul. He's lost his Jewish friends. Most of the Christians don't understand him and say he's selling Christianity short because he's not demanding them to become Jews first. It's a pretty lonely mission he's got. But thank God he persevered with it. And he said, so he's been crucified, metaphorically. This is the point. It's no longer I who live. It's the Messiah living in me. And then he describes, Paul describes what his life now is. And it would be wonderful if we could all say this. The life I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God. His faith in God, his "into your hands I commend my spirit." His belief in the garden that whatever people would do, God would be with him and sustain him. He's never alone. And that gave him the strength to keep going. The life I live in the flesh, I live. It's his faith that's given to me. Jesus' own faith, of course. He gives us his love, his hope, his faith, his courage. I live by the faith of the Son of God loving me and giving himself for me. Now, we can all say that. Well, the offering is there anyhow. Pauline quoted this in the first evening of our, first morning of our retreat from our founder, Jules Chevalier, a book he wrote on the Sacred Heart in the turn of the century, 1900. From the heart of Jesus, pierced on Calvary, I see a new world coming forth. A great and life-giving world, inspired by love and mercy. A world which the church must perpetuate on the whole earth. Because the church is Jesus' body, his eyes, his hands, his lips, his heart. We're in it, so there's sin in the church, but Jesus handled that pretty well in his public ministry. He can still handle it, as long as we keep learning how to love. So the church is to make this world, searching for all these things, real for today. Jesus showed us that when people behave badly towards us, we don't have to respond in the same way. Love one another, said Jesus, just as I have loved you. Jesus showed us how to respond in love even in the worst situations. We can't always forgive. We probably can never forget. There'll be things in our life that we can't resolve because other people won't let us often. But we can love. It is this which makes Jesus' message so convincing. It's this that draws us to follow him because all of us want love. And so does everybody in our lives. Father, forgive them, he said. They don't know what they're doing. It's not a bad way to start when other people hurt you. We needed to see Jesus live loving on the cross. Not because God demanded a crucifixion, but because nothing less could convince us that in our suffering we, like Jesus, are surrounded by the unconditional and persistent love of God. Suffering, even when unjustly inflicted, doesn't have to stop us. If in our human way we're to imagine God responding to the crucifixion, every image we talk about God, they're all analogies. We can't find the right words for God. We just have to choose the better of two alternatives. We talk about God loving and so on, because loving is certainly better than unloving. So we choose that and we go along that track into the mystery. And all theology can ever do is point us to the mystery that's beyond words, of course. Well, why don't we imagine God weeping? Jesus wept over the city. He didn't go in and fix it up. Well, isn't Jesus the revelation of God? So God is weeping over the crazy death of those people just recently in the plane and so on and so on and so on and ISIL and it goes on and on and on. And in our own personal lives, things happen. And we might make the mistake of saying to God, why did you allow this? Why did you allow the crucifixion of Jesus? God didn't allow it. God created people with freedom and they abused it. God wept when Jesus died on the cross, of course. But he didn't stop loving Jesus. This is God's reaction to all the terrible injustices that we humans inflict on each other by our sinful rejection of God's loving inspiration. God cannot pretend that things are other than they really are. So when I sin, it mucks things up for me and you and everybody. And God's not going to say it doesn't matter because it really does matter. What Pilate did when he washed his hands mattered terribly. What the high priest did mattered terribly. But it didn't stop God loving Jesus. Hence, our redemption. Sin can't change the truth that God is love. All it can do. It can stop me welcoming the love because I've got my back to God. But God won't stop loving. Eternally. Because God is love. This love demonstrated in the way Jesus died is the source of all our hope. If we believe it, we may dare the journey out of sin. If enough people believe it, there's still hope of realizing Jesus' dream of God's will being done on earth as in heaven.